Pastor Susie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Members of the Court, my name is Jerry Susie. I'm the attorney on appeal, Cook. This case has been before the court a number of times, really two only which are relevant. First was a direct appeal decided by this court in 2003. There were a number of interlocutory appeals between then and today, which are not at issue. The case went to hearing on the second amended motion for post-conviction relief. After an evidentiary hearing, Judge Durf denied relief. The grounds raised in the second amended petition, I believe there were five or six grounds on appeal. I've raised two, one related to the erroneous exclusion of Mr. Cook's testimony at the time of trial based on the state's objection on hearsay. The second was based on ineffective assistance on trial counsel exposing to the jury a shock belt during Mr. Cook's testimony. The issue of what are the standards concerning ineffective assistance are fairly well defined under the Strickland case, and you have deficient performance which must then be coupled with prejudice. In terms of the deficient performance on the failure to object, I think the record is crystal clear that not only did Mr. Loeffler not object to the exclusion of his client's testimony, but he failed to make an offer of proof at time of trial, and more importantly, he specifically knew how to make an offer of proof, which he did on several different occasions during the trial. On other matters. So it's not like he was an inexperienced attorney and didn't know what he had to do and what his responsibility was where evidence had been wrongfully excluded. The second part comes to the question of prejudice. Now, for the purpose of prejudice, I think you need to deal with the exclusion of evidence on behalf of the defendant in a little different context. I have had cases where the prosecution not only is presenting confessions and eyewitnesses, and they go on with forensics evidence, and you want to stand up and you want to say, Judge, stop, you're piling on, this is too much evidence, we're taking too much time. And the court consistently says, so sad, too bad, the prosecution has the obligation to present the evidence as best they can, you're taking a beating, that's the way it goes. The same goes with the defendant, though, where the defendant is presenting as his defense, I was present at the time of the homicide, and I interacted with the person who I claim was the actual murderer. That was Mr. Cook's defense at time of trial. His defense was, yes, I was with Mr. Hornbacher, but Mr. Hornbacher is the one who killed the woman. In addition to that, Mr. Cook has to present evidence to explain his own behavior. Gee, Mr. Cook, if you were an innocent bystander during this horrible homicide and sexual assault, why didn't you go to the police? And in that regard, whether or not you deal with what the law says, the practicality is that Mr. Cook needs to explain his behavior, which to the average citizen might appear to be not correct. But in this particular case, Mr. Cook wanted to explain that the reason that he didn't come forward, all of his actions were precipitated by the actions of Mr. Hornbacher threatening him, and that Mr. Hornbacher had these conversations with him during the homicide and then, more importantly, after the homicide, when Mr. Hornbacher is explaining to Mr. Cook what Mr. Cook needs to do. Now, here is what I consider to be one of the key points and one of the absurdities of what happened with this hearsay objection. Mr. Hornbacher was allowed to testify concerning his conversations with Mr. Cook. I believe it was the morning after when they're riding around in the car. However, Mr. Cook was precluded from testifying to his version of what was said during that conversation.
Does his version come in some other way in the trial?
No. No, it did not. The threats from Mr. Hornbacher did not come in another way. When you deal with what happened out at the scene, Mr. Cook did testify as to what happened out at the scene. But the threat from Mr. Hornbacher to explain Mr. Cook's behavior, his failure to go to law enforcement, and so forth, did not come in. And that should have come in. It was admissible.
So was the failure to make an offer of proof raised as a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal?
No, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that was an issue that was raised by the state for the very first time in their appellant's brief. It was never raised by the state below.
Does that matter?
Yes, it does matter.
Do we consider procedural bars de novo?
Because it's a waiver. It's a waiver. The state can have a legitimate reason to waive a claim of procedural default, and I dispute whether it was procedural default. The issue that was raised correctly, I submit, by the appellate lawyer, was that the evidence was inadmissibly excluded. She was correct on that. She was correct that Denise Ross, and Denise Ross was correct in saying that the judge made a mistake in not doing that. The first time it ever appears is when this court, not the Attorney General's office, this court said that, well, that well may be true, except that since Mr. Loeffler didn't make an offer of proof, we don't have grounds to consider whether or not it was prejudicial. So this court didn't say that Ms. Frost was ineffective. What they said was, you need to go back and find out why Mr. Loeffler did what he did. That was what was raised in the post-conviction motion. That's how the hearing was held. That was what it was decided on, and the first time this ever appears is in the state's brief. One of the things I think you need to be concerned about is setting aside and looking at the whole concept of post-conviction motion. Post-conviction differs from civil cases, it differs from criminal cases. We have criminal statutes regarding the rules of criminal procedure. We have civil rules of procedure. There are no rules of post-conviction. There are none. There is no rules in the Supreme Court. What you have is you have a statute with a line in it that talks about what you're supposed to do regarding filing the motion. Every rule of post-conviction default and everything has been judge-made on a case-by-case basis, and then they sort of build up. And I submit to you that it's becoming a bed of sand to try and figure out what the rules are of post-conviction appeals, what you have to do. In this particular case, factually, Denise Frost did exactly the right thing. She said, here is a hearsay objection that should not have been raised, that should not have been granted. If you have a rule, as you're suggesting, that it needed to be raised by Mr. Cook on his second amended motion that Denise Frost was in effect, what that means is that Denise Frost, on her direct appeal, needs to assume the mantle of the Attorney General's office and say, okay, Supreme Court, here's my assignment of error. My assignment of error is that this hearsay objection was improperly granted.
And you're not raising a layered claim of ineffective assistance in this case, is that correct?
It was not alleged, it was not considered by the district court. As the appellant, I can't raise an issue that wasn't decided by the district court. That rule is universal. But with Denise Frost, if you adopt the rule that you're suggesting, what Denise Frost had to have done was saying, this hearsay objection should not have been granted. However, I would like an advisory opinion from this court in terms of whether or not the state might raise a claim of failure to make an offer of proof, and if that's the case, then Mr. Loeffler was ineffective for not making the offer. And there is a whole laundry list of potential objections that a state can make. But I submit to you that the defense lawyer on appeal should raise the issue in front of him and should not be required to go through and come up with all of the potential objections that the state might make or the court might find later on and say, but if this is what you're going to say, then this is our response. And if you don't go that way, you do this, and this is our response. That turns it into absurd. Denise Ross did it correctly, and it's very hard for me to say what she did was wrong. And the issue never addressed itself until this court issued its opinion. So you take the case that is in front of you, and the case in front of us was that this court said, yeah, that's an interesting issue. We might consider it, but without the offer of proof by Mr. Loeffler, we don't know. So I don't know how you then turn it around into a layer claim, as you're suggesting, when that's not...
I wasn't suggesting anything. I'm just trying to be sure I understood your argument.
Yes, I mean, but that's the argument. Thank you. I see my time's expired. Is there any questions?
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Stacey Faust, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. I'd like to take a moment to clarify how procedurally we should be hearing Justice Stacey's asking questions of counsel on that issue. Cook has assigned two errors concerning ineffective assistance of trial counsel. One, the first is for failing to make offers of proof about his conversations with Hornbacher before and after Stoliker's murder. And the second is for asking him to show the jury the shock belt that he wore on his arm under his clothing. But as argued in brief, we should not be here discussing ineffective assistance of trial counsel on these issues. We should be discussing layered ineffective assistance of counsel claims for these issues. Cook had different counsel on direct appeal. Steve Loeffler represented him at trial. Clarence Mock and Denise Frost represented him on direct appeal. Mock and Frost did not raise either of these issues, ineffective assistance of trial counsel for the failure to make offers of proof, and ineffective trial counsel for having him show the shot belt to the jury, either of them on direct appeal. This court's precedent is well established. The defendant must raise claims of ineffectiveness on the first available opportunity, which here would have been on direct appeal because he had new counsel. Therefore, the two claims of ineffective assistance of trial counsel, as he now assigns and argues here, are procedurally barred. Having said that, the state recognizes that this matter is complicated by Cook's allegations in his post-conviction motion, the district court orders, and now the assignments of error on appeal. Because of these complications, the state will address the shock belt issue because Mr. Cook did present that as a layered claim in his post-conviction motion. Before the court granted an evidentiary hearing, it construed it as a layered claim. And after the evidentiary hearing, it treated it as an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim.
Might that have been because of the way it was presented at the evidentiary hearing?
I agree.
I mean, is that a fair assumption to make?
Yes, okay. Because Mock and Frost were never called. They were never deposed. It was all about Steve Loeffler. So yes, that's a fair inference. The state submits that Cook failed to establish deficient performance or prejudice on the shock belt issue. Mr. Loeffler testified that showing the shock belt to the jury was trial strategy. It was to explain any of Cook's fidgeting and nervousness that he might have, and this was especially important in this case as he testified because Cook's credibility was so important. In Mr. Loeffler's eyes, it was Cook versus Hornbacher. And if the jury believed Mr. Cook, then he would be acquitted. And so in order to be proactive, he had Mr. Cook show the shot belt to the jury at the beginning of his testimony to explain any fidgetiveness, to explain any nervousness that could undermine his credibility. And I don't think this was an unreasonable trial strategy, especially given Mr. Cook's own arguments to the district court that he has this long family history of medical history of heart problems, and that makes him extremely nervous. Alternatively, he's failed to establish prejudice because of the remaining evidence supporting his conviction. Hornbacher had an alibi, and frankly, the state believes that Cook's version was so unbelievable that there's just not a reasonable probability that the jury was going to acquit him, even if they had not seen that shock belt for the moment that he stood up and showed it to him on his arm. Finally, if this court should address the other claim, which the state maintains that it shouldn't either because it has never been asserted as a layered claim, or frankly because there's been no assignments of error here about ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, this court should address it. He can't show prejudice. Mr. Cook did testify about seeing Mr. Hornbacher kill Ms. Stoliker. He testified that right prior to the killing, there was an argument between Hornbacher and Stoliker. Mr. Loeffler attacked Hornbacher on cross-examination. The defense theory to the jury was very clear that Hornbacher was the killer, not Mr. Cook. And therefore, Cook's testimony about Hornbacher's statements before and after the murder, frankly, were either cumulative or irrelevant or meaningless. and the state would also submit its same prejudiced argument for the other claim with regards to the rest of the evidence that supported his conviction. Rest.
Your opponent this morning has suggested that by not raising the procedural bar before the district court, that the procedural bar arising from failure to raise at the district court at the direct appeal was somehow waived. What's your response to that?
The state's response is that the procedural bar cannot be waived by the state for four main reasons. One being that it is a question reviewed de novo by this court. The second is that this court's jurisprudence is very well established that a claim has to be presented the first opportunity, which on here was direct appeal. So we couldn't have argued on direct appeal. Like, it's now that it's our first opportunity to say this other than at the trial court level. But, and this court has recently held in Robertson that the civil rules of pleading don't apply to post-conviction in Nebraska. And so to say that the state can waive a procedural bar would effectively mean that this court is disapproving or overruling Robertson and applying the general rule of pleading to the states, specifically section 61108 for pleading affirmative defenses. And fourth, I think it would ignore the post-conviction statute itself because the district courts don't even have to provide notice to the county attorneys of post-conviction motions unless they grant an evidentiary hearing. So on many of these, the state may not even be aware of the motions themselves, and I don't know how you can hold that the state would waive any defenses on cases of which they may not even have notice on.
I guess that perhaps raises the question, the procedural bar, what have we said that its nature is? Is it a defense or is it something different?
Well, I think according to this court's jurisprudence, it's not a defense. It's a de novo question. It's simply, we're looking at the previous proceedings and was it raised? It's never entered this court's opinions, at least to my knowledge, that the state ever had to do anything. We're just looking at the previous proceedings.
Thank you.
There's no further questions? We ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day is...